Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you might be in the world. Welcome to our online event, the House of Contradiction, or La Casa de la Contradicción, hosted by the LSE School of Public Policy and the Latin American and Caribbean Center. I am Andres Velasco. I am the Dean of the School of Public Policy here at the LSE, and I'm very, very happy to be chairing this event today. And especially happy to be welcoming our friend, professor and distinguished Latin American public intellectual, Jesús Silva Herzog Márquez. And of course, also joining LSE Professor of Practice, Vanessa Rubio Márquez, no relation as far as I know, who will be providing some comments. Before I introduce our speaker with more info and details, just a few housekeeping announcements. If you're using Twitter, there's a hashtag, and that's hashtag LSE Public Policy. We are recording the event. I hope that's not a problem. And the event will be a podcast later on. The format is as follows. I will introduce a speaker who will have about 20 minutes to tell us about his book. And then we will have Vanessa come in with some comments. I will take the chair's privilege to ask a question or two or three, as the case might be. And then we will open it up to questions from the floor. Please use the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen. Now, let me introduce Professor Silva Herzog, or Chucho, as friends and admirers call him and know him. He is a professor at the Escuela de Gobierno and Transformación Pública, at the Tec de Monterrey in Mexico. He did undergraduate work in law at UNAM in Mexico and graduate studies in political science at Columbia University in the city of New York. He's had many, many appointments. He's been a Woodrow Wilson Fellow in Washington, DC. He's taught at Georgetown, at the New School, at the University of Chicago, at Columbia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But perhaps more important than any of that is that I think Chucho is one of Latin America's leading public intellectuals, a writer full of insights on the big topics of the day, liberalism and democracy in particular. And for those of you who speak and write Spanish, and I will say this very much from the bottom of my heart, he is one of the great prose stylists writing in Spanish today. So, Spanish-speaking students on the call, after we're done, go on the internet, look at his most recent essay, look at his most recent book, and there are plenty of them, get a good sense of how Spanish prose ought to be written and how beautiful it can be when done well. He's written many, many books. I will not list them all. One of my favorites is The Idiocy of Perfection. And perhaps my favorite short essay is one called La Duda y la Fe, Redefiniciones Liberales, about the style, the talante of liberals, always full of doubt and distrustful of excessive certainty. The book that Chucho will be speaking about today is called La Casa de la Contradicción, or The House of Contradiction, and it is about the tensions built into liberal democracy and the difficulties that Mexico has found in recent years, or recent decades, I suppose I should say, in living with democracy and consolidating democracy in that country. So without further ado, I do not want to hog the microphone. We want to hear our guest. So Chucho, the floor is yours. You've got 15, 20 minutes to tell us about the book, and then we will move over to Vanessa. The floor is yours, Chucho, and again, welcome to the LSE and welcome to this conversation.
Well, thank you very much, Andres, for this wonderful presentation. Thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation, for this possibility of having this transatlantic conversation with two people that I admire, two colleagues that are really inspiring as people that you want to get engaged in an intellectual conversation. I'm looking forward to the debate, to the conversation. So I would like to keep my presentation as brief as possible. But I would like to start with something that you just said, Andres, and that is what is the genre that this book tries to place itself in? This is not a work that I would call a work of a political scientist. This is not a work of political science. This, none of these chapters would be allowed to be published in the American Political Science Review. And this is because this work tries to place itself in an intellectual tradition that is the tradition of the political essay. And if I have this, if there's this title of the book, The House of Contradiction, that wants to be a description of the contradictory nature of liberal democracy, it is also a reference to the style of the argument. The style of an argument that is open to its own contradiction, its own tensions, its own doubts that are inside the argument itself. That's the reason why the opening line of the book is a reference to the father of the essay, Michel de Montaigne, in which he refers to his own, to its deepest character as a man that distrusts his own impulses and has and is in look for the opposing idea in order to keep it healthy, as you could say. So it is an essay, and therefore it is somehow of a rejection of the conceptual restraints of theory and the conceptual restraints of science. I admire the conceptual elaborations of political scientists. I, for example, admire Adam Shavorsky's minimalistic understanding of democracy. I think these understandings are clearly useful for the portrayal of a democratic regime. They are clearly necessary to draw the lines between a democratic system and an authoritarian regime. But I would insist that if democracy is a living organism, if it is if we can trace its life throughout the centuries, we should not look for a definition of democracy, and therefore we should learn from the greatest philosopher of democracy that we have ever read, that has been Alexis de Tocqueville. If there's a theoretical inspiration in this book, I would say it's Tocqueville's Democracy in America, a work that places democracy in the center of the title, but never attempts to define democracy. And if you look throughout the chapters of this wonderful essay of meditations, of ruminations, of deep thoughts, of observation of everyday life, you would find many contradictory notions of democracy. And I think that the richness of democracy in America, the richness of his perception of democracy being the greatest challenge of our time, the contemporary a problem of our present, we should understand that rejecting the traps of definitions, I think it's one of its most valuable contributions to the understanding of democracy. And I place this chapter on the nature of democracy at the beginning of the book, because I believe that if we want to reconstruct the history, the brief history of Mexican democracy, one should understand that the one of the original problems of Mexican democratic transition is that we were not able to understand democracy as the problem it is, as the challenge it is. And therefore, I believe that we push for democratic transition and electoral reforms with the idea that democracy was that this garden that will solve each and every one of our problems, because we were able to solve electoral competition, and we were able to establish a legitimate and popular administration and government that would be able to deal with social demands. So democracy should again try to understand and appreciate the contradictory nature of democracy. If we want to appreciate the life of democracy, its lasting appeal, its seductiveness, I think we should appreciate its opposing ideals. So that is the first argument that I try to put forward in the book. Democracy is a regime of contradictions. It is a mirror in which the people wants to recognize itself. It is a battlefield in which elites are selected. It is an open space of deliberation. It's also the experience that's it's somehow felt as an anxious experience of uncertainty. And it is also the administration of defeats, of frustrations. And I try to color this contradictions that are seen in the history of political theory, because I think democracy in the case of Mexico was a misunderstood ideal. And this is, I think it's not an Aztec peculiarity. This is something that might be common in many parts of the world. But in the case of Mexico, I think we experience a peculiar type of democratic transition. Mexico's pluralism did not have a golden past to go back to. It didn't have a democratic memory. And therefore, I think that Mexico's transition to democracy was felt somehow of a beginning that was inaugurated with a great naivete in many aspects. There was an interesting discussion in Mexico at the beginning of the 90s, a discussion between maybe the highest peaks of intellectual debate and literary writers in Latin America between Mario Vargas Llosa and Octavio Paz on the nature of Mexican authoritarianism. I think it was an interesting debate because Mario Vargas Llosa, invited by Octavio Paz, defined Mexico's post-revolutionary politics as the perfect dictatorship. This is such a perfect dictatorship that it has been able to use democratic clothing. It has been able to present itself as a democracy, but it is a dictatorship. It is even a perfect dictatorship, the ideal dictatorship that is a dictatorship that is not seen as such. Octavio Paz was clearly against this caricature. The pre-regime was not a democratic regime. It was not a pluralistic regime. It did not hold competitive elections throughout his reign, but it hasn't clearly been a dictatorship. It has been an hegemonic authoritarianism. And in this sense, Mexico's transition to democracy placed its hopes in the magic of elections, in the idea that votes would solve everything. And the second part of the book deals precisely with the experience of democracy since the year 2000, the year in which Vicente Fox was the first president that came from the opposition, the first non-priista president in Mexico's history. And it is a series of political frustrations. One of the most interesting, I think, criticism that the book has received was one that José Woldenberg, once head of the electoral board in Mexico, an admirable intellectual that comes from a very rich experience in the left in Mexico, said that the book was troubling in sense that it was too presidentialistic, because it concentrated in the presidency of Vicente Fox, in Felipe Calderón, Enrique Peña Nieto, as if they were the owners of politics in Mexico, and it didn't understand structural forces, other types of political constraints, and I think he has a point. But I believe that these presidencies are an eloquent illustration, maybe even somehow of ideal types of three types of diseases that Mexico faced in the first life, in its first democratic life, from 2000 to 2018. Vicente Fox, the first Panista president from the year 2000 to the year 2006, represents somehow the naivete of an administration that believes that history has changed substantially because votes have been counted. And the idea that after we got rid of the old authoritarian party in the presidency, everything would build itself to get to achieve transparency, to eliminate corruption, to generate economic growth. it was not simply a mistake, an illusion of the elite. It was a national drunkenness. I remember I comment this in the book. There was a fascinating poll a couple of months before Vicente Fox was inaugurated as president. The newspaper Reforma organized a poll on the expectations of Mexicans from the new government. And it showed that the majority of Mexicans were convinced that Vicente Fox was going to be able to solve every problem that Mexico faced in 6 years. Vicente Fox was going to be able to generate growth, to eliminate corruption. It was going to solve the education problems, was going to generate the rule of law that was needed, and was going to be able to fight crime. There were the most cautious of the people that were portrayed in this poll thought that he was going to achieve these goals, not immediately, but in a couple of years. So if we inaugurated a democracy with this type of expectation, it was clear that we were headed to a terrible frustration, and that was something that we experienced, we have experienced in this first era of democracy. Felipe Calderón is also a symbol of one of Mexico's worst experiences with pluralism without the rule of law, that was violence. Felipe Calderón's administration decided to initiate the war against crime, the war against drug traffickers, the war against organized crime. I argue in the book that this was not the war of necessity. It was a war of election. It was a war that was fought without a clear diagnostic of the problem, without a clear idea of what were the resources of the state. And in terms of its consequences, it threw Mexico in a spiral of what I would call barbarism. Mexico has grown as a more pluralistic society, a more democratic society in many aspects, but also as a more barbaric society. I try to color this experience through the lenses of poetry, of art installations that try to show how this violence is basically the air that we are breathing in Mexico since 2006. And Enrique Peña Nieto, the priista that won the presidency in 2012, is also an ideal type of the other deep problem of this democratic experience, that is corruption. So we have in these three presidencies the childishness of expectations of a democracy that does not recognize the challenges of a pluralistic society, the violence of pluralism without the rule of law, and the humiliating experience of corruption that clearly bred the populist impulse that has helped Andrés Manuel López Obrador in 2018. The third part of the book is clear, is that portrayal of contemporary politics in Mexico. I'll try to accelerate this part so that I don't rob more time of the conversation. But the third part of the book is tries to portray López Obrador's populism not as the disfigurement of democracy that the first part of our democratic experience meant, but the demolition of the democratic structure, because it is clearly an anti-pluralistic project in this idea of having not a diversity of interests, a diversity of institutions, but a battlefield, a war between the people and its enemies, and how this is not only a symbolic rhetoric that he plays every morning in his press conferences, but it's also the attempt to capture institutions or destroy institutions. It is also the demolition of democratic structure because it is a militaristic project. And I think that this has been the greatest surprise that we have faced with López Obrador's administration. His strongest, his closest ally in his 3 years of president of as president of Mexico has been with the army, with the military, that have not only been his allies in the fight against organized crime, but have been his allies in his infrastructure projects, in many aspects of his administration, because he believes that the Mexican military are really the people in uniform, as he continuously says. So this is basically the structure of the book, a theoretical idea of what are the contradictions of democracy, the roots of our democratic frustration from the year 2000 to the year 2018, and a picture of our contemporary challenges with a fairly successful populism strategy that I believe is the greatest challenge, the greatest menace to liberal democracy in Mexico today.
There we go. Thank you very much, Chucho. That was concise. That was very clear. It's not an easy book to summarize because, as you point out, it's not a paper. It's, you know, there's no table that you can show with results, but that's precisely what makes the book so appealing and so fascinating and full of subtleties and, dare I say, contradictions, like democracy itself. Let us move on to Vanessa now, to students at the LSE. Vanessa needs no introduction, sorry, but for those of you who may not be part of our community, Vanessa has been a very, very important and leading policymaker in Mexico. She was the Deputy Minister of Finance, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, and the Deputy Minister of Social Development. She led a presidential campaign. She was a member of the Mexican Senate. So I am sure Vanessa will have a special and detailed take on how this approach to democracy plays out in Mexico today. Vanessa, the floor is yours, and we very much look forward to your remarks.
Thank you so much, Dean Velasco. And it's a pleasure to be here with Jesús Silva Herzog Márquez. I count myself, fortunately, amongst his friends, his fan, and a former student of Chucho many, many years ago. And I totally agree with Andrés that he is one of the brightest and sharpest minds of political thinking and political analysis in my country, Mexico, but also, of course, in wider Latin America. And proof of this is the book that he's presenting today, La Casa de la Contradicción, The House of Contradiction, which is a fascinating dissertation and a very lucid one on exactly what he just described, a provocative reflection on democracy, its limits, its disenchantments, and the way we should look into democracy to be able to understand its depth and manage expectations about democracy. So in Chucho's own words, democracy is not paradise. It's something more modest, the only political inconvenient compatible with dignity. And when one thinks about dignity in terms of respect, decency, and giving value to our humanity and to our freedom, this is a very relevant and a very pertinent piece of thinking. So Chucho gets us started, as he mentioned, with different ideas and a very intimate and very interesting conversation with Tocqueville and Rousseau and Bentham and Stuart Mill and Constant and Weber and Popper and Arendt and Gramsci and Berlin and Laclau and Urbinati and practically all the main thinkers and philosophers and political scientists and lawyers around the idea of democracy. And basically what Chucho concludes is that there's no single definition around democracy, and that democracy is inherently contradictory. And I cannot state this enough, no? Contradiction being at the ontologic core of democracy, which I think is a fascinating concept and one that we should have in mind in a juncture where democracy is being challenged, when there's huge disenchantment around democracy. But one should give thought on why is that, if it's not related to what we thought democratic institutions would bring about, what democratic institutions will solve, but it's much more to that, no? So again, let me have a quote on Chucho, which I agree again with Andrés. The book is it's a fascinating read and it's beautifully written. The unstable compound of democracy always looks in opposite directions. It is trust and suspicion. It is a mechanic and an ethic, a procedure and a civilization. It is debate and decree. It is the election that picks up the voice of the majority and the tribunal that stands for the weakest. It is the space in which everything is questionable and nothing is imposed as sacred. It is a mirror, a forum, a battle, a whip, a number, more than a complex regime, a contradictory one, a guarantee of disappointment. And perhaps amongst the most common disappointments are, I think, expectations and content of democracy. Expectations in regards to the fact that perhaps we have asked too much from democracy. Democracy alone will not solve all of our problems, and we cannot blame democracy for all of our problems. But again, without democracy, our problems would be definitely deepened and far more complex. No, in the absence of democracy, we would be having a much harder time to trying to disentangle and solve our problems. And there you have what you mentioned at the end of your presentation, Chucho, this pendular politics and polarization and populism being at the rise in this current context. And the second disappointment, or more common disappointment, I think, besides expectations, is content of democracy. So democracy, as you mentioned, is much more than elections. Sometimes we saw elections as an end itself, and you described very much what happened in Mexico in this regard. But I think many of our students from around the Latin American continent and around the world can also relate to this, to countries in which we saw that election as being the democratic anchor and sometimes the democratic end. But there's much more to that, no? There's the understanding that the elections is a must and is a prerequisite, but perhaps it's just the beginning of the democratic journey, no? We need laws, we need institutions, we need practices, we need checks and balances. We need to have democracy as an ideal and as the aspiration, and sometimes to think about also intangibles as many of the ones that are described in the book. You mentioned one that I think is quite relevant in this post factual world, which is the wheel of truth, the truth being both the floor and the ceiling of debate. And debate in itself being the natural mechanism to administer pluralism. So I think all of this touches on the many nuances and the many elements that we need to have in mind when we think more thoroughly about the achievements, the limits of democracy and democratic life. And I think you published this book at a critical juncture, at a moment in which we can think about democratic fatigue, about democratic disappointment, about disenchantment of democracy in itself. I very much worry about this exercise that is being done in many classrooms in the world. I certainly did it in my classroom in the previous term, in which you ask students if they would be willing to sacrifice 20% of democracy to earn 20% more. And you get many hands raised with a lot of honesty, no? So what does that say about democratic disenchantment and democratic disappointment? I think it's worth to think about. And you, of course, have Fukuyama with liberalism and this discontent. You have Anna Applebaum with the twilight of democracy, and you have Pinker with the scarcity of rationality and so on and so forth. So I think it's a perfect moment for this book to be read, for this book to be digested in all of its magnitude. And I also think that you mentioned something very relevant around populism, and I cannot stop thinking about populism in the context of Mexico, but in the context of the larger world, no? Russia, Turkey, the United States, Latin America, and many countries, no? And this magical thinking and these great expectations about democracy that you describe on Vicente Fox, I think it's the same thing that is happening right now with Andrés Manuel as of 2018. Great expectations, magical thinking, as if the leader will come and solve all of our problems. But here we are in 2022, and we are very far from having one problem solved. You name it, no? Democratic strengthening, no. Economic growth, no. Inequality, no. Poverty reduction, no. And militarization of the country, no. Violence, no. So again, what is it about these expectations that we put into leaders, that we put into those that have a democratic rhetoric, but at the end tend not to deliver, no? And the clash between those aspirations and reality, no? And you can understand a lot about the disenchantment in Mexico and in the world around these ideas. I found a great degree of disenchantment, I must confess, with the new poll of Reformas newspaper just 3 days ago, when you ask people in Mexico, what do they think about Andrés Manuel and the way he has handled the economy and the way he has handled the country. And basically more than 60% think that he has handled it better than anyone else in the previous recent past, no? So how do we come into terms with, again, this disruption between reality and the data and the features of the regimes? So I don't want to go any further, but I think you're, again, I would stress the fact that your book comes at a very relevant time where there is a crisis of political representation, the effects of technology and social media, the demolition of institutions, militarism around the world, magical thinking in countries such as Andrés's in Chile, the rethinking of the social contract and the rethinking of the social contract around the ideal of democracy. So how to come to terms with this contradiction? I am fine with being disappointed. I am fine with living in this contradiction, but I am not fine with living without democracy. So how we can organize ourselves to better, better, to be a better society, to have that democratic ideal there, to manage expectations, and to hopefully live up to the task of being a more democratic world, a more democratic society, and one that at least has democracy at its ultimate goal. So these are my initial comments, and thank you so much again, Chucho, for this wonderful book, for this wonderful and provocative reflection on democracy.
Thank you, Ernesta. Those are great remarks. I propose we do the following. I am ready to go with a few questions of my own, but before I do that, maybe Chucho, you want to take a couple of minutes to react to anything Vanessa said. We have about 45 minutes, so plenty of time to chat and engage in a dialogue, but let me hand it over back to you, Chucho, for any thoughts to complement Vanessa's remarks, and then I will fire my own questions. I think you're muted, Chucho.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Vanessa, for your reading. Thank you for this perceptive reading of what was I trying to convey in the book. And I would like to concentrate on the last part of your comments on this surprise that many people in Mexico have on the a stubborn popularity of López Obrador, because one may say that in objective terms, there's not much to be proud of. There's not much to say about economic growth and better levels of safety in Mexico on the administration of health policy in terms of the response of the pandemic in Mexico. But López Obrador is still a highly popular president in Mexico, and it is not only that he is popular as a leader, but it's his popularity has been reflecting in the popularity of his party. That it was something that we used to say, this guy is popular, but this is something that is not contagious because this is a exceptional historical figure, but his party is not not going to benefit from his popularity. Well, that is wrong. And I would have two comments on that. First is that I think that we are trapped in this utilitarian idea of democracy that I think is wrong. We have this idea, the elitist perception of democracy has told us that democracy is basically the hiring of politicians so that they can solve our problems. So as we hire a plumber to solve the problem in our bathroom, we hire this guy to solve that particular problem, and we will hire him again if he does a good job and it is cheap enough for our budget. Is that the way that we practice democracy? I think it's not. We are not evaluating politicians in terms of what they are doing in administrative terms. And that is the depth of the populist revolution. And I do believe it's a revolution in terms of how it magnetizes politics in an other perspective. Because that utilitarian calculus is not working anymore as it used to work. Why is he so popular? Because we believe that we are safer going outside our houses and walking in the streets at night? No. He is popular because he is seen as one of us. And that is as strong as possible claim as one can do in politics. Is he doing a good job? No, I don't think he's doing a good job. Maybe it's as bad as the other guys, but he speaks like me. He tells the people that have been humiliating me for all my life what I want to tell them. I'm with this guy. And the second thing that I would say is that he is popular because popularity in is always in relationship to others. And maybe we have not faced this in Mexico. And that is something that I try to say in the book. Maybe I would emphasize that more today. Our traditional party system was destroyed in 2018. It was destroyed. It was not hit, it was not damaged. I think it was destroyed, as the French political system was destroyed. And Macron understood that. But how many votes did the Socialist Party get in France? What we see in terms of what the PAN and the PRI and the PRD are getting in terms of voters right now shows that they are basically zombies. They have not realized that they are dead. So why is this political structure so popular? Because he faces zombies in the street that have not been able to say anything relevant after 2018. So this idea that if you get all the zombies together, they are going to be able to push an attractive alternative, I am really doubtful about that. They have just given the Princesa de Asturias prize to this great Polish journalist, Adam Michnik. I read from him this image that I think is brilliant on the aquarium and the fish soup. You can cook fish soup with the things that you have in an aquarium. You cannot recreate the aquarium after you cooked the fish. I think that's what happened in Mexico. The political party system was destroyed.
Thank you. As I listen to you speak, I cannot but reflect on how widely applicable that is as an observation. You mentioned France, you mentioned Mexico. In the same sentence, one could mention Peru, Brazil, Chile and so many other countries where traditional parties went down the drain. Some of it may be good, we needed renewal. Some of it, of course, is terrible because there's no democracy without political parties, and how we reconstruct a party system to appeal to the many voters who are disenchanted and skeptical is one of the big questions. But I want to rewind, use my chair's privilege, and sort of along the same lines of what Vanessa and Jesus have been discussing, but maybe with a slight turn, I would like to invite Chuchu to reflect on liberalism and democracy. This book is about democracy. A number of your earlier books are about liberalism. And in this book, there's one sentence that I found quite stunning and quite scary. And it seems to me that it's a good starting point for a discussion. You say, el liberalismo invita a abandonar la fe democrática, or in English, you know, liberalism is an invitation to abandon, not faith in democracy, but sort of democracy's faith. Another way of saying this is that one of the many contradictions you allude to in the book is, you know, liberalism is one thing, democracy is another, and they're not always best friends. Democracy is majority rule, or maybe that's one very narrow way of describing it. Liberalism is a way of ensuring that majority rule does not trample on the rights of the minorities. Liberalism is a lot more than that, but, you know, that definition alone provides grounds for contradiction. So there's three bits of this contradiction, Chucho, that I want to invite you to think about. Let me begin with a third one that follows exactly from what I just said. You're not the only writer out there. And if I think of Yascha Mounk, the German-American political scientist, has been thinking about the same lines. There's a very narrow but very concrete way in which democracy and liberalism seem to have clashed. You know, liberalism is all about making sure that the voters don't trample upon the rights of minorities, trample upon the rights of people who advocate what is unpopular today. But that seems like a very hard equation to uphold today. Let me give you a few examples. Liberalism, you know, loves things like autonomous entities, you know, the comisiones electorales, the autonomous electoral commissions that say to the ruler, don't do that. But of course, that's a counter-majoritarian. You know, independent central banks are counter-majoritarian. Technocracies of all kinds are counter-majoritarian, but they're all liberal, precisely because they look after those who did not win the last election. In Mexico, this tension between liberalism as sort of the defense of the minority and democracy seems particularly acute today. One of the things, of course, that AMLO has been doing is weakening all those autonomous institutions. But every time he does so, voters seem to applaud because, of course, those institutions were, you know, people with technocrats, you know, people with degrees from the United States. And of course, who loves technocrats nowadays? Nobody does. You know I am the dean of an institution that trains technocrats. So we're keenly aware of how much skepticism there is out there, and not only in Mexico. So how do we resolve this particular contradiction between liberalism and democracy? How do we resolve it in Mexico and more conceptually? I have two more coming, but let's get started with that one. Or maybe we don't have to resolve it. Maybe it's an inherent contradiction and we should learn to live with it. Very keen to hear your thoughts on this.
I think we have to learn to live with those contradictions, because they are actually contradictions. I do believe that the role of a constitutional court is to pronounce the word no, even if that's popular, even if the poll says that a majority of citizens want to throw these migrants out of the country, that is not according to our values, the values that are built into the Constitution. But I think, Andres, that there's maybe the need to approach the issue with an archaic perspective in terms of recognizing the importance of technocracy, and to build in itself a sense of prudence, of sensibility. Going back to the issue of French elections recently, I was struck by the clarity of Le Pen's denunciation of Macron, the ultimate technocrat, as the embodiment of this arrogance. I believe that a school as the one that you lead, the school as the one that I teach in Mexico, that are basically these schools that deal with educating people to have the resources to solve public problems. I think one of the most urgent things to teach is that you don't have the last and the only word. And there's also the need to explain, to reason publicly, to understand the skepticism of the people that say your degree is not enough for you to say what we have to do. And in that sense, I believe that we have to go back to the idea that democracy is a place where we can have a conversation together. And if technocracy is the place where the guy tells you you're an ignorant, you don't know anything about that. And please thank me, because I know what's best for you. Mm-hmm. We are going to we're heading for this Brexit notion that we are fed up with experts. To hell with experts. Because if the experts say that, I know that's against my own interests. Because I have been hurt by this expert that are the worst type of experts, because they're paternalistic, because they're condescending, because they tell me that I'm really not aware of what I really, really need.
Let me agree with one thing you said, Chucho, and disagree with one. I will agree that, of course, arrogant experts that come with this attitude that we know it all, you know, we become hateful people, and voters are very right to kick them in the behind. And that's what they've done in the UK, in France, in the US, in Mexico, in my own country of Chile, and so many other places. However, I am less persuaded that doubt is what voters want, and certainty is what they dislike. Herein lies another big tension between liberalism and democracy. Earlier today, I was looking through some of your other writings, and I was reminded of a passage that I really like. I'm going to read it in Spanish. Forgive me if there are any people in the audience who don't speak Spanish, and then I will translate. You say that, this is about liberalism, you say, por los meandros de la vacilación, abierto a la perplejidad, el liberalismo se afirma ante todo como una disposición intelectual, lo contrario a una ideología, esa certidumbre que permite a la gente dejar de pensar. Liberalismo, pues, como talante, una actitud, un estilo político, no un recetario. I completely agree with you, and I'm going to translate as I go here, that liberalism is, you know, the enemy of certainty. So these technocrats who say, you know, I know everything, are being very illiberal. Liberalism is really a style of politics in which, you know, if you're a truly good academic or a truly good intellectual, of course, the first thing you know is that you don't know a lot, and you should admit to it. So as a statement of one's philosophy, we are on the same boat. However, I have been a practicing politician, and I know that if you give a press conference and a journalist says, you know, sir, what are you going to do to address inequality or poverty or global warming? And you say, well, I'm full of doubts. I'm not quite sure. Let me get back to you. You're not going to get a lot of votes. And if there's something that is very striking about the political climate today, particularly in social media, is that, you know, there's nothing more unfashionable than doubt. And there's nothing more appealing than certainty. And populists are the very, you know, first people to understand this. You don't hear AMLO or Bolsonaro or Trump or Marine Le Pen saying, well, I'm not quite sure. Let me look into the data. I'll get back to you. They are full of certainty, but they're full of a different kind of certainty. So what is it about, you know, populists that enables them to sound so certain, act so certain, and still, you know, avoid being disliked, while the liberal technocrats sound certain and they come across as priggish, unpleasant, untrustworthy? Is it simply a matter of human resources policy? You know, all these, you know, rich, arrogant, white technocrats like Macron come across as being dislikable? Or is it more like that? More than that, sorry.
Well, fascinating discussion. I completely agree that one does not vote for a doubtful politician that highlights how complex the issue is, that he cannot give you a straight answer. This is something that Michael Ignatieff talks about in his fascinating book on his political experience, and that's the difference between the intellectual and the politician, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I agree with you on that. I think there's this I don't know. I'm thinking out loud, but is it the source of the authority that one brings to the conversation in comparison to the other? Because I try to relate how the populist and the technocratic argument are somehow related in terms of two ways of rejecting the conversation, the deliberation, the openness of politics, and closing the discussion through a perception of an unquestionable authority. This is what my macroeconomics textbook says. This is what the soul of the people defines. In both arguments, there's nothing to discuss with that. I think we should try to make the effort of breaking those hermetic statements. Is it useful in the Twitter era? I don't know. I think this is a great debate. Is this something that is hashtagable?
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Very, very difficult issue. You know, one thought maybe, this is a conjecture, is that if a politician begins by saying, I understand that you may not trust me because X, Y, Z, but nonetheless, this is the best that I can do. You know, when I was to be in politics, you know, the people who worked with me who knew more about media and communications than I did used to say, you know, you should convey certainty, but you should begin by acknowledging that other people may not find that certainty very appealing. At least you connect with the audience, right? If you simply speak from the top of Mount Olympus, then people are going to turn off the TV, shut off the radio, and go elsewhere. But before I give up my control of the microphone, and I do want to get back to Vanessa in a second, but one last line of contradiction, Chucho, between liberalism and democracy. And this goes back to some of Vanessa's points about identity and credibility. Liberalism is, by definition, universalistic. we uphold these values, you know, to be self-evident and applicable everywhere. People have dignity, people are entitled to freedom, autonomy is paramount, etc., etc. And it would seem that the hallmark of populism nowadays is exactly the opposite. As you pointed out, people don't like AMLO in Mexico because he's particularly competent or particularly educated or particularly able. They like him because he looks like us, sounds like us, talks like us, and ultimately, you know, maybe one of us. And therefore, identity is paramount. And identity is always local. It's never universalistic. You know, we don't have it's very hard to construct an identity as a member of a human race. You can have an identity as a Chilango or a Mexicano or a Tabasqueño or Latinoamericano. It's hard to be very general, very universalistic, and appeal to an identity. So in the identity race, populists are winning by default. And the big question, of course, that arises, and people like Fukuyama have been writing about this, I've written a bit myself, is, you know, whether liberals and Democrats can engage in identity politics, but of a different kind. Not an identity politics that is based on the color of your skin or your religion. You know, if you think about white supremacists in the US, they like to scream blood and soil as they march down the streets. We don't want an identity politics based on blood and soil that's profoundly illiberal, but maybe there's a different kind of identity politics, one that is based on pride of belonging to a particular culture, a particular country, love of land, love of culture, love of Mexico. So is there a liberal democratic identity politics, and can Democrats use it to fight populism, or are we stuck? And is democracy going to be the eternal loser in this particular confrontation?
I think that's maybe the one of the most pressing challenges that democracy faces today. I do believe that there's the need to rethink. I don't know if identity, but belonging. To share something that's deeper than your individual experience, to share a language, a flair of life, some type of memory. I think that there is this open possibility of thinking nation without nationalism. I think that's
George Orwell, a century ago, gave us a language to talk about
of
that.
Of course,
you know, he said patriotism is a good thing, nationalism is a bad thing. Nationalism is hatred of others, patriotism is love of our own. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a liberal patriotism.
I think there is something. I am moved. I should confess with the things that I'm seeing in Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's a sense of belonging that is not responding to Russian aggression with the idea that we have a culture that is essentially different. No, we have a civic arrangement that we want to keep. I think that is an image of something that I think is desirable, that is attainable, that is open, that it's not an idea that defines that, or an idea that freezes culture as the definition of what is the nation, and it's something that it's somehow petrified and has to be protected, but something that has to be lived and changed and contaminated by something else. But that's I think a very complex challenge of contemporary democracies.
No, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, what we see in Ukraine, of course, is terrible and heart-wrenching, but also it may show the way forward. There's no other way of understanding, you know, the extraordinary courage of Ukrainians. It is, if not in the way you describe, as, you know, love of our own and something that brings us together. And, you know, it was a country that was very divided between mm-hmm. East and West, between mm-hmm. Ukrainian speaking and Russian speaking, between Orthodox and Catholic. And suddenly those divisions seem to recede mm-hmm. once confronted with such a threat. Mm-hmm. All right, Vanessa, why don't we hear from you? And we, you know, I'm sure you have thoughts to add. We have three questions in the chat and I want to get to them, but let's give Vanessa a minute or two to react to these fascinating things that Chuchu has been saying, and then we will go to the questions.
Just very briefly, and trying to extrapolate the expectation part of democracy to the expectation part of perhaps not political parties in specific, but opposition. Haven't we helped kill political parties and kill opposition? And now we're asking too much from them. So when I think about the opposition, no, it was there, and I agree that criticism is a part of democracy, debate, pointing the fingers, asking for transparency, accountability, all of that. But aren't we also to blame when we think about how weakened the oppositions are, how disanchored the oppositions are? And now aren't we asking too much from them? No, you're on the floor.
You're the one to blame for.
No. Not where the blame is, but in terms of what we ask, in terms of expectations from the opposition. You know what I'm saying? In terms of where you are at, no? And you are disanchored, you are disaccredited, you are, but now you should stand up and now you should give the fight and now should, I always question myself about this. And I thought of exactly the same sort of context in terms of the expectations of democracy. No, we expected too much of democracy. Aren't we expecting too much nowadays from opposition, given the fact that they have lost ground, they have lost anchor, they have lost legitimacy? So mm-hmm. how do we expect them to sort of recover and be fighting and be forceful and be credible, even credible?
Yeah, I get that your point. But shouldn't we expect that after the train that went over them in 2018, they would try to understand what happened? I think that is something like even like a survival mechanism. I've just been hit by a truck. Let me see what is still living in me, what is healthy in me, what should I get rid of after this? That is something that I haven't heard from anyone of these parties. And what I hear from them is basically the idea that this is a balloon that's going to how would you say, a balloon that's going to not explode, but it's going to get rid of
the dilute
air and fall. Mm-hmm. By just the time. I mean, in a couple of years, this balloon is going to fall. And we will be here to recover power. I think that's absurd. And what I hear from them also is this strategy of nostalgia. How happy were we in November of 2018? Is someone really going to buy that speech? That we were very happy in the year 2018, and then we are losing everything after López Obrador. I think this is a call for defeat. So yes, maybe we are expecting too much of opposition parties, because we are expecting that they are opposition parties, that they are structures that are thinking of their circumstance, that are elaborating a diagnostic of what is happening in the country, that are building bridges with their constituents, that they are keeping track of what's doing the opposing element. I don't see that. And I do think that we should emphasize that we are not having that from that camp.
Agree. The point of departure and the, is not the rainbow that they tend to think, and the mea culpa is not there. So absolutely agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me use that very wonderful exchange to jump straight into the questions. And in fact, there's three of them. We have 15 minutes. So we are in very good shape. And I'm going to read them in an order such that we connect with the point that Chucho just made. So the first question I want to pose to you, Chucho, is by Rosa Maria Velez, who says that, you know, is the political system, the political party system, destroyed? Or maybe what's been challenged is the concept of democracy, and more fundamentally, the ability of the old parties to represent people's interests. Because, and Rosa Maria points out, Morena is a political party and it seems to be doing just fine. So is it a problem, with political parties in general in democracy, or is it a problem with the traditional political parties in Mexico? And she adds, you know, given whatever your answer is to that, how do you envision the future of the Mexican party system?
Well, I agree with Rosa Maria's comment. I would limit the criticism of the party structure in Mexico to basically to the opposition, the traditional party system that has been destroyed. I believe that the new majority party, Morena, has problems. It is strongly personalistic structure. It has not institutionalized itself. I don't think that it has a clear idea of what it wants after López Obrador, but it is a party. It brings people to the polls. I think it's doing its job. And if we look at the polls that Vanessa was referring to, well, it clearly is renovating participation in the institutional process, and therefore is very helpful for the legitimacy of Mexico's democracy. What I don't see is the traditional parties coming to terms to what happened to them after 2018. What I believe is that I don't believe that the attempt to re-elaborate, to reconstruct the hegemonic structure of politics can be successful in Mexico. So I don't believe that Morena will be the new pre in terms of being able to dominate for decades to come the party structure in Mexico. I would envision the strengthening of regional party systems in Mexico that reflect the diversity of politics and of demographics of everything that we can see in such a diverse territory.
Thank you, Chucho. I was encouraged by the thought that Morena is not destined to become the next PRI. I hope you're right.
I think it would love to be that. I don't think it can do that.
Well, maybe there's only one PRI in human history. It's hard to run a country for such a long time in today's world. Okay, let's move on. Next question is from Jonathan Ojumeru, And he puts this question as a follow-up to the exchange you and I had about technocrats and legitimacy. He says, is there a way for politicians to try meaningfully to separate their sources of authority, authority for policies? On the one hand, there's sort of a factual authority coming from technical expertise. And secondly, there may be, you know, moral authority or moral legitimacy coming from the fact that these are elected officials. So they have a mandate, and a democratic mandate also has some authority. Can one mix and match between the two? Is there a way of combining the two that endows expert politicians with the ability to persuade the electorate?
Well, I think that would be I think that would be very attractive. The idea that the technocrat is not only able to do the math, but also tell the tale that is attractive. I think it's difficult. Yeah. To bridge the two languages, because they are actually two forms, two ways to understand the world and to understand your responsibility. But if we go back to the idea of populism and its seductive nature, I think it's the recovery of the narrative construction of politics. Mm-hmm. One needs to tell a story. And I think it has to, one needs to build the bridge between the math and the myth, the math and the story, the future, an attractive idea of the future.
So there we have it, with alliteration and everything, the math and the myth. I will in fact use that, Chucho, because one of the things that we discuss with our students, many of whom are on the call today, is precisely how it is that somebody well-versed in the math can also tell the tale and mythologize the myth. Not easy. Some politicians are extremely able and manage to do that, but very, very few. It's hard to find, if you look at world history, it's hard to find examples of politicians who can do both. Or those who do so in a very particular way. You know, maybe Macron has managed to do some of that, but but so far he's better at the math than he is at the myth. He was just lucky that the traditional party sort of imploded at exactly the right time, so he got a clean break. Not everyone is so lucky. Mm-hmm. In any case, we're nearly out of time, and I want to get to the last question. And that question is by Ricardo López Cordero, who's an LSE student from Mexico. And he says, question for Jesús. Hola, what should be the role of the media in nurturing a democracy in which different sides and political parties can live in necessary and productive conflict? So democracy is not about holding hands and being lovey-dovey. There is tension, there is conflict, civilized conflict, but conflict nonetheless. In politics, media should live with this, but perhaps not exacerbate the conflict beyond a certain point. But I'm not quite sure what the limit is. Mm-hmm. Can you illuminate us, Chucho?
Well, hi, Ricardo. Great to that you were able to get into the Zoom. I think this is a crucial point. We need professional media. And I would say that the first responsibility of the media and of journalism is being professional, being able to portray what is happening, what is really happening, going away from slogans, going away from this polarizing simplification that is somehow the temptation of discourse in contemporary politics. being able to explain what is happening, because I think that what we are facing is somehow this oversimplification of the world, over emotionalization of the world, and I think that the media, journalism should, and this also maybe Andres is not that popular, because simple tweets are more popular than complex information. But I think that's the job of the media to show that the issues of the world are not simple like or dislike, are simply yes or no, but how can we achieve the those goals that we are trying to reach? I'm not sure if I was able to answer.
No, I think you answered it very well, but you also point to the inherent difficulty in that problem. Steven Pinker, in the recent book that Vanessa quoted earlier, has a line that I like. Pinker says, "You have never turned on the television set and found a correspondent who says, 'I am reporting live from a country that has not broken into civil war.'" a country not breaking into civil war is not news. Or as you know, the Brits like to say in the world of media, if it bleeds, it leads, right? Mm-hmm. Good news is not news, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a natural tendency to exacerbate the degree of conflict. You know, I learned this as a politician. You know, if you have a press conference and announce a wonderful industrial development policy, and you speak well of everybody in the cabinet in doing so, you will be in page 27 of a newspaper. If you have a press conference and say that one of your colleagues in the cabinet is completely inept and should lose his job, you're going to be in page one, right? And that's very, very hard to overcome. I am married to a journalist.
There's also, I think, Andres, in the case of Mexico, I'm thinking about it. If it bleeds, it leads. But also, if it bleeds too much, it bores.
Yeah.
And that is something that is especially dramatic in Mexico's case. Yeah. Yeah. We are somehow willing to ignore the horrible violence of our country. Yeah. Yeah. So we don't like to, we are no longer willing to see the horrors of the country, maybe just a turn for the soap opera.
Well, Mexico is not alone in that. I remember visiting a country in Central America, not too far south of Mexico recently, and noticing that an item of news that, you know, a dozen beheaded bodies had been found in a ditch was not on the front page, right? In most countries it would be. And once you get to that level of violence, it recedes to page 27 again, which is quite depressing, I suppose. All right, we are 1 minute short of our appointed time. Vanessa, would you like to use that last minute to add something?
Thank you. Not really, just to thank Chucho for his presence here and to invite our audience, both English and Spanish speakers, to get acquainted with Chucho's work. In the case of Spanish speakers, La Casa de la Contradicción, you're going to enjoy the reading. We have gone through it throughout the discussion here today. And one cannot be aside of this discussion when we are at the School of Public Policy, when we're at the Latin American Center, and when we are citizens of the world that are concerned about democratic ideal and our path towards achieving a more democratic society to hopefully live better. So thank you so much, Chucho, and thank you so much, Andres, for chairing the event.
Thank you, Vanessa. Chucho, my last words are simply to say thank you. I think it is very seldom, even in this wonderful series of LSE public digital events, to get a conversation that is so full of insights on issues that are so damn important. The tension among populism, liberalism, democracy, I think is at the core of contemporary politics, whether the country in question is India or Israel, Ukraine or Mexico, the US or the UK. And of course, the list goes on and on. So absolutely crucial issues and absolutely wonderful insights into very, very difficult topics. That's not something that we can say often at the end of an event. So to Jesús Silva Herzog, many, many thanks. Un abrazo grande, and we hope to see you soon live in London so we can carry on the conversation. And for those of you who have joined today, thanks very much, and we shall see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.